was missing. So we're going to eventually get to transforming problems into happiness. And we need to, but to do that, we can't just jump into it. We need to see the framework, have the context. Because it's a more advanced stage of practice, even in the advanced stages, which is the compassion wing, which is like university level, using that analogy. We love the word compassion. We love the idea of Buddhism being all about kindness and compassion. That's very common. It's amazing that people think that, you know, want to be compassionate, want to have compassion. But we don't realize our view is profoundly limited, you know. We just don't realize it. And we certainly don't realize that our compassion is polluted by our attachment. So we'll go into this as we get along. We'll move along. We'll get more into that. But let's stick to karma here and get a bit more analysis about karma and to get the fundamental point that I am sick of suffering and I know I have to change myself and take responsibility and be accountable and grow up and realize that what I do with my body and speech and my mind first brings results to me. I'm the creator of myself. This is the one that takes us the longest for some reason. I don't know why. It's very fascinating. We just hear it vaguely as punishment, reward, restriction, not allowed to do this, not allowed to do that. We don't really think of it carefully. And if we don't do that, we're becoming childish. You know, we're not understanding Buddha properly. It's unbelievably important. So if we don't do that, we'll never get what Rinpoche says is called renunciation. We'll never understand our mind. We'll never understand attachment. So we can never understand compassion properly, and we can never become a Buddha. So we're just going to not be superficial. We've got to go more deeply, you know. So in general, if we use that simple example of killing the mouse whatever, my example of abortion, for example, the key factor in those four pieces, those four components of a negative action, and equally a positive action, the key component is the second one. The key component is the mind involved. Speaking very simply, I mean, as you study more and more, you know, people in this place studying more and more the master's program, I think getting into the incredible nuanced detail of this amazing literature, this amazing philosophy, but to keep it really simple. We can get to the essence of it, you know. The main factor is the mind. And not even the intention. Not even I will kill. That's not even the main factor. It's the motivation that impels the intention. But the trouble is for us, they so totally come together, we don't even split them. We don't even notice there's two pieces there. So because we're brought up, let's say, with a disgust for mice, aversion for mice. They're dirty, they're disgusting, and in our culture, you naturally kill them. We don't think it matters. And this is an interesting point because it's scientifically, we don't think they've got... Now maybe people are studying animals and seeing that they suffer. But really, the typical view in the scientific world, which is in the Christian Judeo world, which comes from the Christian view and the Jewish view that God doesn't give a soul to animals, then we've already devalued them for a long time. For centuries, you know, they don't have value, they don't have souls. And the scientific view just repeats that by saying they don't have many feelings, they don't suffer. I mean, I remember one time a few years ago, one of those, you know, animal rights people saying that fish suffer. And on this, you know, on one television show, and the journalist was just shocked at his stupidity. He was laughing at him like an idiot. Do you mean fish suffer? What are you talking about? And even only now in science are people beginning to prove that animals are sentient beings and have suffering. It's just bizarre. I mean, the Buddhist view is the suffering is a billion times worse than ours. You know? They have the physical suffering, the suffering of the bad things happening, and they have mental suffering. This is an absolute revelation to us. Lama Zopa said one time years ago, one friend told me at Kopan, Rinpoche said, if just for a moment we could have a direct insight into the suffering of the mind of our little dog, the suffering would be so intense. And he meant the mental suffering of the neuroses, the mental suffering of the ego grasping, the mental suffering of their attachment, the mental suffering of their ignorance, the mental suffering of their anger and all the other delusions like us would be so unbearable. We would never want to waste another second of this precious human life. Now, that is absolutely shocking for us to hear. Nobody thinks animals suffer at the subtler level. They get hurt, yeah, they get starving, that we understand. But we never even think they have a mind. We don't even think they suffer. We don't even think humans suffer. We don't, unless we don't see the physical suffering. We don't even understand the second kind of suffering. We don't even understand the suffering of delusions. That's how deluded, that's how ignorant we are, you know. If you see a person smiling, you can't see their mind. Therefore, you can't see their suffering. If people don't show by their behavior what they're feeling, we can't see it. Therefore, we don't know their suffering. We don't even think having anger and attachment is suffering. That's how it shows how stupid we are. So the motivation and intention, they're all so powerful, so spontaneous, so continuous, that it's just automatic. So automatically we think mice are horrible. Automatically, because the world approves of it, we just kill the mice. And we're considered a clean, nice person because you just killed 100 mice. Oh, great, your house is lovely and clean now. Nobody thinks of it. We don't think of it. So we don't even think there's a delusion there. We don't even think there's a problem. But the motivation there was both aversion, how disgusting mice are, and that's based on attachment, because I want a nice, clean house. The way we treat creatures in our culture, you know, little creatures. Sure, it's interesting. We have compassion for the ones we eat. Lots of emotions around eating meat, isn't there? Because we're attached to food. We get hysterical about killing the pigs and killing them. Of course, the suffering is shocking. And of course, this planet is being destroyed by the meat industry. But we never pay attention to all the creatures who die on the road. Never think about it. We don't care, you know. So our compassion right now is based on incredible compassion, incredible attachment, you know. So anyway, the point is, in an action that we do, the main player is the mind. Not even the intention to do it, but the motivation that impels the intention. That's the key. That's the point. And right now, Buddha's view, his analysis of being a samsaric person, this is our philosophy, samsaric philosophy. We are samsarists. We're driven by the motivation of attachment. It's just the way it is. It's just how it is. And then some things we do are then motivated by anger, and then some things we do are also motivated by ignorance, specifically. But attachment is runs a show, you know. And if we want to understand attachment more deeply, we have to understand that this realm itself that we exist in, having this very body, is the product of eons of attachment. We created these five senses. We're not made by some creator. These are the product. Having penises and vaginas and ears and eyes and noses and all the organs of our senses, they are created karmically. Karma's like kind of karmic evolution. Over eons of time, we created, our attachment created these five holes or things that go into holes, you know. We created this body. We're not made by some creator. It's not a sacrament. It's called suffering. It's called, you know, mental illness. So living in this body, having this body itself, which is the product of attachment, we naturally have to live according to the rules of it. That's all pervasive suffering, the third kind, the most subtle one. This is really primordial stuff, you know. So any action we do, for it to be a complete action, let's say, and lots of actions we do aren't complete, there's always some piece missing of those four. The key player is the mind. And among the intention and motivation, it's motivation. For example, you know, I think, let's say Ron's rich. And I like Ron. Of course, he's so seductive. He's so gorgeous. Because rich people, I really look. If they're ugly and fat and old, no one cares. If they're rich, we love them. Because we want their money. I want his money. He thinks I love him. I look at him with dazzled eyes. I'm so kind to him. He thinks, oh, Rabina's so kind to me. Yeah, I want his money. What do you think my attachment, what do you think my motivation is? Attachment. It's so blatant. It's so evident. But attachment is like a honey-covered razor blade. It looks like virtue. It's so sneaky, you know. Sure, I've been kind to him, but my motivation? Totally attachment. And as depressing as it might be, most of our goodness now is that. And this is my point. When you really get tested, when your attachment gets tested, look at your love. Where does it go? Out the window. You're happy to be kind to your poor friend next door who gets depressed. You bring in for a cup of tea and invite her and are so kind to her. But what if she never goes? You want to kill her in a day. She wants to keep staying with you and keep having a cup of tea and keep being with you. No, thank you. Get out of my house. Our compassion's got very low limits, you know, because attachment's not getting what it wants. This is kind of it seems brutal, but it's evident if we look into our minds, our lives. Our compassion is very limited. And then, so anyway, the main key is the motivation, not even the intention, the motivation. So in the beginning stages of practice, there's no wiggle room. There's no, oh, I will kill because my motivation's good, so it's okay. Oh, I can lie because it's my motive. No, there's no wiggle room there. How you define an action is in terms of its motivation, but Buddha just says, don't do it, baby. Have some discipline. Back off. Do not kill. Do not steal. Do not lie, etc. You get the discipline and you program your mind, especially in the framework of vows. There's three levels of vows that cover all the three levels of practice all the way to Buddhahood. And they all the lamas will say, it is not possible to complete the path without vows. Vows are profoundly, they're potent psychologically. We'll discuss all this as time goes by. So in the beginning stages, you learn the discipline of just back off and do not harm sentient beings. Really learn to discipline and subdue the body, speech and mind. It's a profound practice. And with that as a foundation, we have something solid to grow upon. In another package of teachings, another package of the path, is called the three higher trainings. This is the wisdom wing again. The end result, those three, is wisdom. The ability to see directly the way things exist, specifically to see the absence of the fantasy eye. In order to get that wisdom, you've got to have the second one, which is called concentration, which is the accomplishment of karma by doing this genius technique the Hindus invented. Because why? Because you get to the laser-like subtle focus of the subtle level, which is what's capable of unpacking and unraveling the nonsense and seeing reality. But before you have the second one, you've got to have the first, which is control your body and speech, baby. Live in vows and get ethics. Because the controlled body and speech and controlled mind, the practice of morality and ethics of body, speech and mind, which is junior school and high school, that is what qualifies you to get concentration, to get realization of emptiness. In 1995, in Mandalo, I interviewed one of our marvelous meditators in our organization. This is the Swiss monk, Venerable Rene. Does he ever come here? Never invite him here? You never invite him here? He did come. He's a holy being. I tell you, not that I know anything, but it seems to me he's a holy being. So in 95, I interviewed him about a 1.5 or 2.5 year retreat at Urselling, up in the mountains. His Holiness named it that back in 82. He said it reminded him of Tibet. It's so beautiful, you know, just like a retreat place, little mountain caves. And I interviewed him in 95 about that retreat. And he was, you know, 2.5 years or something. And this is just to get concentration. Just to get concentration so you can start to do some real work. And he said to me, there's no way in the world he would even have been ready to get to the mountains, metaphorically or actually, to get concentration, without first becoming a monk and living in the vows and being a monk. Second, doing lots of purification. Third, doing lots of study. And even fourth, having to teach. These were the preliminary practices, if you like, that enabled him to have enough discipline, enough in his, you know, in his toolkit of practices to enable him to have the incredible concentration and discipline and perseverance to sit in the mountains 12 hours, 14 hours a day, attempting to get concentration. And he was there 2.5 years and he maybe got to the fifth of the nine stages. So we're talking heavy duty, intense stuff here. There's no way in the universe you can get to a refined level of your mind to see reality without unbelievable amounts of practice beforehand. And vows is a potent way of creating that. Which is why vows are so powerful. The first, you've got the Patimoksha vows, the first level, which is junior school and high school. These are the don'ts, you know. All vows are about behavior. They're not about the mind. They're how to control behavior. And the first level of vows are known as individual liberation. The vows that allow us to achieve our liberation. And they're all about controlling your body and speech. And they're crucially about not harming others. They're all about backing off and refraining from harming. It's called the morality of restraint. So you have the layperson's vows and you have the monk and nun's vows. Behavior. And the essence of the behavior here is to stop doing actions that harm others. Why? So you can develop yourself. Stop sowing more seeds in your mind. This enables you to achieve the first level of realization, you know, renunciation. and then eventually to even realize emptiness. If you want to graduate at high school, if you're a Hinayana practitioner, because it's all the Hinayana teachings, you practice the Theravadan teachings. This is junior school and high school. Then you can complete that and graduate at high school by adding to all your practice of renunciation. You then get concentration, and then you realize emptiness, and in one life or another, you achieve your nirvana, and then when you die, you're out of here, baby. You won't come back. You're finished. You're done. You've got to have those vows. It's not possible without. Not possible. And why? So in junior school, there's components of a major practice. The essence of it is stop harming others. The essence of that is to do it in the context of keeping the five layperson's vows. And the essence of, and then you add to that the purification. Lama Zopa says we are insane not to do purification practice every night. When we understand that, generally take the 10 non-virtues as your basis, then you start to narrow it down. You live in the five vows or the Mankanan vows. Then you do your purification every day. This is the main components of a practice. And then you can die with a happy mind and guarantee another decent human rebirth so you can keep on bopping on your spiritual path. Not just kind of religious, the practical psychology. So a vow is so potent. Lama Zopa said, you could have two people, one who's doing bucket loads of practice day and night, another person, and doesn't have a vow not to kill, simply. Another person, merely the vow not to kill, but not doing much else. The second person creates bucket loads of virtuous karmic seeds in their mind, plants billions of karmic seeds in their mind, and puts atomic bombs under the habits, just by the power of vows. And the first person, the logic of that is very simple. The logic is very simple. We're sitting in this room now, not killing. Well, we're being nice people. But we're not creating any karma of not killing. Why? Because there's no thought. Your $20 falling out of your pocket for a homeless person, they get the 20 bucks, they're happy. But you didn't create any virtue because there's no thought. So that all the sentient beings that are not being killed at this moment, aren't they happy? But we're not creating any virtue of not killing them because there's no thought. I will not kill. That's the point about karma. It has to be the mind. I will not kill. So the only time then we create the virtue of not killing, which means we sow a powerful non-killing seed in the mind, which brings the habit, and especially if it's got with a pure motivation, it'll bring a decent human life in the future, plus the habit not to kill, plus the... without the karma, without the vow, it's only when we think it and see the creature and decide not to kill, and we pop a little virtuous seed in our bank, our bank vault. But because our merit is not very strong, because our virtue is quite weak now, like we talked, then the karmic seed isn't very strong. And just get a human body in the next life, just to get a human body, you need bucket loads of strong, delicious, intentional, non-killing karmic seeds in your bank vault. So, easy way to create that, without effort, 24 hours a day, to be ticking over virtuous karmic seeds of non-killing in your bank vault and purifying your habit to kill and purifying all the tendencies, the residual results of karma, which we'll talk about. Vows. Vows are the one. Because the vow is so potent, Buddha says. Even in the Theravadan teachings or the Hinayana, I forget, they say something like, that a vow is a subtle physical energy visible to clairvoyance. That shows how powerful vows are. That's so tasty. That's incredible. So what is a vow? Well, it's coming from the Buddha. The Buddha started the vow business, and his people did it. Then they passed on to their next people. And then in an unbroken chain of people, right to the present, these vows are a living kind of power source. So when you take vows, when you first take refuge and then you take the vows, you kneel in front of somebody, your hands in the prayer mudra, you see the person as the Buddha, and then you vow three times from this moment till the time of I die, I will not kill, I will not steal, I will not that, I will not this. And then you put that vow deep in your mind, you put this deep kind of this, you grow this thing in your mind. And it's like you track yourself right back to that power source right from the Buddha, you get it. You're buying into that power source. And then 24 hours a day that you're keeping that vow, whether you're thinking of killing or not, doesn't matter. The power of vow is such that you're ticking over virtuous karmic seeds 24 hours a day. So given that we need a bucket load of decent karmic seeds in our bank vault at death, this is the way to do it. To practice virtue and practice a spiritual path without living in vows is like wasting time. Not wasting time. The virtue isn't strong enough because our virtues aren't strong enough. The point she made was so clear. Our virtues are not strong enough. But vows override that. They're so potent. It's the only reason I'm a nun. What am all this funny-looking 14th century stuff for? What for, you know? It's cheap. It's easier. No hairdresser. My clothing's about $10 a year, so that makes it cheap. They are so powerful seeds in your mind. Huge results in the future. It's like 1,000,000% return on your investment. That's just the Parimoksha vows, individual liberation. Then we have the Bodhisattva vows. They're also about behavior. Well, that's another discussion. We'll go to those later. But there's a crucial difference. This first lot are to protect me from future suffering. You've got to know it for yourself. You've got to be happy to live in vows. Be delighted that you're sowing seeds for the future. Like in a big garden. You see, your boring old garden looks ugly right now, but you're putting all these lovely seeds in it, and you know they'll come in 20 years, and you're excited at the thought of it. This is how it is to think about vows. We're so addicted. Attachment, you see, we're so addicted to feeling good now. We're so obsessed with feelings. We're such babies when it comes to feelings. I want to feel good. You don't care how you feel. You can have a headache and have a knee ache, but you're happy to go to your garden and plant the seeds in your ugly garden full of weeds, but you're happy to pull out the weeds and you're happy to grow the seeds because the fruits will come in the future. We can't cope with that. It's too boring because we want it now. It's very interesting. We're so driven by attachment, by feeling good. We've got to feel good. We're like junkies when it comes to this. We want to feel good. Of course, it's so intense how I'm saying it so roughly. I know that. I have to crack jokes again. If we don't crack jokes, we all go crazy. Are we communicating? You've got to think about this stuff. Don't just believe it. So vows are very powerful. Easy way to create virtue. Easy. Sit back and relax, stick your feet up and eat popcorn and watch telly all day. So an action, the key factor then that does determine an action is the motivation. But that doesn't mean, oh, well, I'll kill with a good motivation. No, as a bodhisattva, yes, you're capable by then. Bodhisattvas have a vow, because the main point about bodhisattva vows is to help others, to help you know what's best for others. The first lot is to protect you from future suffering. The next lot is more profound, amazing. These are to help you know what's best for others. So you here have a vow to break an earlier vow if it's for the benefit of others. That's pretty powerful. So you would kill if you have the wisdom. Like Lama Yeshe, he didn't kill, but it's like he allowed the monk to die, if you like, because he had the wisdom to know what was best for that monk. That's pretty powerful wisdom. And tantric vows are the top lot. That's another discussion again. All about behavior, though. Well, there's some commitments in there about... Anyway. Okay, so the key factor here, talking about what makes a complete action, an action which will bring a result of a type of rebirth, that's a complete action. The key factor in there, it's important to know this, the key factor is the mind. Key fact, the mind runs the universe for the Buddha. The mind creates the universe. The mind is the creator of all hells all the way to Buddhahood. The mind is the boss. That's Buddha's expertise. So, okay. Then the power of vows is also such that this is huge for future results. So I always use these two examples of two little boys, both sons of people I met. One is a friend and the other one I met in passing. One little boy, this mother told me, she always quote this story. For 25 years I've been telling this story. If you've heard it before, I'm sorry to bore you. It's such a good example. She was in Kopan and she just heard Lama Zopa teach about karma and she came to my room in tears. It was her boy, who had died just 5 years before at the age of 29, had been a fisherman all his life. So she, roughly speaking, she told me how when he was a little boy, like five or something, he first went fishing. Well, he fell in love with fishing. So he was a fisherman all his life, and he died scuba diving. Okay, there's one story. The other, and I'll finish. The other one is a little boy, the son of a friend of mine called Daichen. She's a Buddhist. And he was like three. And she was taking the lice out of his head. And he was crying with compassion for the lice. Crying. Mommy, mommy, don't hurt them. It's their home, you know. So neither mother had had a chance to teach these two children. So we can deduce, and this boy who was the compassion for the lice, he's like 40-something. I think he doesn't kill anything. So the difference is this, and this is the real point. This is the tragic one for future karma. We can deduce the little boy who had compassion for the lice and who never bothered to kill for the rest of his life, that he'd created the karma to not kill in the context of vows. The other fisherman, we can deduce he was in the lower realms as a result of killing, like all of us. He exhausted that karma, and like a miracle, not really a miracle, at some point at the end of one life or other, as Lama Zopa says, whether you're a kangaroo or an ant or whatever, one of his virtuous karmic seeds of some past life of not killing was triggered, that then programmed his mind to be born to a human mummy. This is the mother who's telling me the story. So he got the human birth. Then next second track of karma, he had all his tendencies. And he was a nice person, she said, intelligent, kind, generous. But he also had a tendency to kill. But look at this world, human world. At this moment, 7 billion, whatever. Every one of us, everyone who's got the human mummy, that one of their virtuous karmic seeds from the past life, from virtue, from non-killing, was triggered, one bank vault. But look at the humans who kill. I would say it's the vast majority of humans. Think about it. Look at cultures, look at teachings, look at religions. Look at the way most cultures are. Humans kill one kind of sentient being or another. I think it's rare not to kill. Think about it. Well, that's because... So then the fisherman, he continued to kill. He also had the karma to be killed. The third one, he died young, age 29. He was scuba diving. He drowned. The fourth, environmental karma, I don't know what he had for that. So this is the point here. He completed that past karma of killing, exhausted that main result, but he hadn't purified the residual results of karma, which is that carried on in that life, the habit to keep killing and the experience of getting killed. He hadn't purified those. So he continued to kill. And that's the main one. That's the killer. That's the one that's destroyed. The vast majority of humans, we can logically deduce, will go to the lower realms when they die because they've got the habit to kill. Because they've got the karma to get the human body. That's one karma. But because they haven't purified by living in vows and by purification. Living in vows and purification purify also the residual results so that you wake up in this life or you wake up in next life with no thought to kill. And that's the most precious one. That's the one that's most precious. So one lama said, you want to give any piece of advice to one person, one piece of advice, don't kill. At least attempt to not kill. And for most people in the West, that's almost impossible. So when His Holiness gives vows now, when he gives refuge and vows in, say, Dharamsala, he doesn't give it as a vow not to kill creatures. He just says, don't kill humans, because he knows most humans find it too hard to even think about not killing the cockroaches and the rice and the rats and the mice, you know. So it shows how primordially deep the habit to kill is. And this is the one that sends us to the lower realms again, that causes future suffering. So at least live in a vow, at least that, to not kill. And the others, how marvelous. And then... So stop harming, then take the vows in the five lay vows, so powerful, which helps your mind 24 hours a day practice, 24 hours a day create virtue, 24 hours a day, and vows have the power to not only create merit as well, but to purify, whereas merely not killing only happens when you intend not to kill, occasionally. Then purify. We're insane not to do it every day. We'll discuss this practice at some point. They're the tools we have. They're the tools we need to use to ensure we have a decent life and we're creating marvelous seeds for the future. And this is the one that is the hardest for us, even as Buddhists. It's so hard, like I said before. It's so hard for us to think of the future. All we want is good feelings now. All we want are addicted to good feelings now. So if we think we're practicing virtue now and it makes us feel good now, we think we're doing a good job. If we're practicing virtue now but we don't feel good, we think it's wrong because we're junkies for good feelings. This is very depressing and very brutal to hear this. We've got to have real courage, you know, to understand the logic of karma. And if we don't, then we're not making the wise choices for our practice, you know. This is really intense. We understand it when it comes to things like going to the gym. We understand it like things like eating properly. Many people get, and there's so many environmental sicknesses now, aren't there? People get sick if they eat certain food. You never follow your feelings. You know because you understand nutrition. You trust the logic of nutrition. And especially if it's your children or yourself, you will never, ever even try, even think to eat something if you're not certain it doesn't have that poison stuff in it, because you know you don't want suffering in the future. So we get it when it comes to food. We're prepared to sacrifice our feelings now and eat the food that will only bring good results. But we will never, even if it feels good, we know we're stupid in eating the bad food because it'll bring future suffering. We understand it, but not when it comes to virtue, not when it comes to morality. We're like babies. We are junkies and want to feel good. It's like attachment. It's childish. It's attachment. Getting what it wants, like the dummy in the mouth, the baby, you know. If we understand the logic of vows, if we understand the logic of vows, we'll be so blissed out to take them, so blissed out to keep them, you know, for our benefit. It's for our benefit, for our benefit. But we've got to have the view of our mind continuing, which is very hard for us. It's not natural for us to think that way. So the key factor in general that determines an action to be negative or positive is the motivation. That's what I'm discussing here. Well, different things. The motivation. So that means you can argue. You know, on the one hand, you can say an action of generosity is a virtuous action. It is. And an action of killing is a non-virtuous action. It is. But you can see, based on the motivation, the karma you create won't be that simple. So I could offer Ron 20 euros because he's looking for the money for his taxi, and I know he's got money, I know he's rich, and I want him to love me, so I'll happily give him my 20 euros. He'll think I'm being so generous. But my motivation is really lousy, so you can't say I create much virtue. I give him 20 euros, that's just physical. My hand goes out and gives him 20 euros, that's my hand. What's my mind doing? Manipulating, attached, wanting more money from him. That's disgusting. That can't be virtue. How can that be virtue? It's not. Equally, with no motivation, the 20 euros falls in front of the homeless person and there's no thought there, then there's no karma. And you can even argue a negative action called killing. You intend to kill that mouse, but here your motivation is compassion. Well, this is your pussycat. I know everybody goes into tears when they think about this one because everybody's killed their pussycat, you know, because out of compassion. Of course you kill your pussycat out of compassion because you see the pussycat suffering. So your motivation's okay. You say compassion, but as His Holiness says, compassion's not enough. As Lama Zopa says, meaning well is not enough. You mean well. Oh, my God, my poor pussy's suffering. I must kill it. Please, veterinarian, please kill my pussycat. You meant well. You're not being negative. You meant well. But you don't have wisdom. And what's wisdom? The clarity, the confidence that when you kill your cat, that you know a virtuous karmic seed will be triggered and she'll get a really nice human mummy and be able to practice virtue and practice her spiritual path. That's wisdom. And if you've got that, kill your cat. If you've got that wisdom, kill me right now. Thank you very much. How kind you are. But who's got that wisdom? None of us. So stop playing Russian roulette with your poor pets, you know. So part of a problem is, too, that compassion is there, which means you don't have much negative karma of killing. You could argue there's no negative karma of killing, possibly, depending on your motivation. But it doesn't mean you helped your cat. There's two things there. One is your meaning well, your compassion. But you should ask the question, well, I killed my cat, and I did mean well, okay for me, but did I actually help my cat? We never ask that. But if we've got the Buddhist view, we know the cat's mind will continue to another rebirth. And death is a very difficult time. We'll discuss all this later. At the time before you even stop, before your pussycat stops breathing, the conditions will be all there together that a karmic seed that will be triggered then is triggered then that will determine her next life, before she even stops breathing. So, you know, and we don't have that certainty. We don't have that wisdom. We're not clairvoyant. So your main thing with your pussycat is to help her be happy and safe and secure. Because if her mind is peaceful, then it gives a chance for virtuous karmic seeds to be triggered. And if you play mantras for her, that's super powerful. That'll soothe her mind and it will invoke the Buddhas and will help a virtuous karmic seed be triggered so your pussycat can die in peace when she's ready, you know. So meaning well is not enough. You need wisdom. But for you, karmically, not so bad. But that, you know, That's okay, because the motivation is the key factor. You could argue that. All I'm trying to do here is show the centrality of the mind, even though we're discussing behavior, to really see the components of an action. The mind is the key factor. That's why in the end we have to learn deeply and to become familiar with our mind, understand negative states, understand positive ones, get some concentration so we can do the job of being a Buddhist, you know. Just look at the vows. There's this little list, as I said, this little checklist of 10 don'ts. The first 7 are the body and speech. Then you've got, that's a general kind of advice from the Buddha. It's advice, like the doctor. He's not the boss. He's not forcing you to do it. He's not saying he's going to punish you if you don't. It's advice. And what's the advice for? Well, you know, it's just simply advice, how to do something. But as soon as it's religion, we get nervous, isn't it? Like if you drive a car, if you think about all the don'ts you have to learn, you'd have a long list. Don't do this. Don't drive that way. Don't go in the wrong lane. Don't pass over this way. Don't put your foot on the brake the same time as the accelerator. Don't do this. Don't turn the wheel this way if you want to go that way. There's hundreds of don'ts, but you don't get all suppressed and miserable by all these don'ts. Someone's telling me what to do. Someone's telling me how to drive a car. I want to do what I want to do. You don't think that. You are delighted that someone gives you instructions. But as soon as it comes to religion, we get nervous because we think it is punishment, you know. Someone's squashing us. Well, what's advice? Vows are just simply instructions, guidelines from the Buddha about how to turn yourself into a marvelous person. The road rules and the road instructions are how to turn you into a decent driver. This is to turn you into a good person. Who doesn't want to become a good person? Vows and these instructions are that. They bring that benefit. From an expert called the Buddha, you know, it's up to us. Don't just blindly believe him. Look into the logic of it. And then want to use this as a basis for your life, you know. So vows, as I said, gives enormous power to our actions. Lama Zopa says it's not possible the life we've got now, which is not just the human body, it's got also got all the conditions we need to be able to practice, and that comes from generosity. Morality of non-killing gives us the human body, all the conditions of having access easily to things and money and food and jobs, that's from generosity, being born in a decent environment. And then from past practice, we've got the wish to continue to practice. That's what they call the perfect human rebirth. This is amazing, incredible. Now, I forget what I was saying. Where was I? I forget. What did I say before that? What did I say? Remember Siliana? Oh, no, I can't remember. She just lives in the moment and speaks what I say. I can't remember what I said. What did I say? Vows. I know, yeah, that's right. Yeah, okay. Wait, I'll come back. Yeah, thank you, thank you. Exactly. All of this life we've got, he said it's not possible. This has come from just being a nice person. It's because we've lived in vows of morality. So if what we've got now is the fruit of living in vows, we want it in the future, we better keep living in vows, baby. It gives great power, both purification and creating virtue, like bucket loads of virtuous seeds, 24 hours a day, purifying all the habits and creating the virtue of the opposite action. So powerful, so potent. So what we've got is the result of living in a spiritual path, living in vows. Then you've got purification. As Lama Zopa says, we are insane not to do it every day. And again, this is powerful psychology. And it's all on the basis of understanding how karma works. Very simply, that whatever we think and do and say sows seeds. So it's the four, you know, the four powers or whatever they call, you know, in the teachings. And a good way to remember them in English is the four R's. Different way of presenting, but this one, the first one we can say is regret. The second is reliance, not refuge, reliance. The third is the remedy. The fourth is resolve. It's easy to remember the four R's. So let's analyze these steps. Again, psychologically, don't hear it as religion. Don't hear it as kind of like, you know, with prayers and Sanskrit and bells and all this stuff. Just keep it fundamentally simple. So regret has to be the first step. It's acknowledging to yourself the things you've done with your body, first of all, with your body and speech, that have harmed others. First level is that one. So at the end of the day, not when you're too tired because you go to sleep, but you recall the day. You check up, you recall the day and the few things you've done that day with your speech or your body that have harmed sentient beings. You recollect them. And then you regret. So regret is so specific, and this is one of the ones I've noticed all over the world. It's really hard for us to hear. So His Holiness the Dalai Lama one time, and I always quote this, so sweet. One person asked, what's the difference between guilt and regret? So the guilt that we understand is like this, as His Holiness said. We look in the past and we go, I did this and I did that and I did this. But then immediately, and I'm adding these extra words here, automatically, without question, we then conclude, and I'm a bad person. This is totally natural for all of us. Having ego grasping, having this dualistic view, causes us to run to that absurd, exaggerated, inaccurate conclusion. And what it is it's anger. When you say, if I'm angry at Ron, you did this and you did that and you did this, and then I conclude, and you are a bad person. This is exactly what we do with guilt, but we are the object. So it is anger towards ourselves. It is very simple. It's finding fault, and then this is the crucial thing. The crucial thing, when we talk more about the mind, we get back to high school, the key function of all the misconceptions, of all the mental illnesses, of all the afflictions, of all the disturbing emotions, all these different terms for them. The key function, this is crucial to understand. When we get this, we get Buddhist psychology. We get why we suffer. The key function is they embellish. They exaggerate. So, you know, attachment exaggerates Ron's deliciousness. Aversion exaggerates Ron's ugliness. Ego grasping, ignorance, exaggerates the very ontological status itself of ugly Ron, delicious Ron. That gives it the concreteness and the absoluteness. That's ego grasping's function, which informs all the other delusions all the time. They're all misconceptions, all lies in the mind. They embellish. As Lama Zopa said, they all decorate the delusion, the misconceptions in the mind, the mental afflictions, the mental illnesses, the disturbing emotions, decorate on top of what is there, layers upon layers upon layers of characteristics that aren't there. That's how they function. That's the cause of all suffering, and that's what we have to see and to unpack and unravel and deconstruct and remove those misconceptions from our mind so we can become a Buddha. So, guilt is regret, as His Holiness said, the first step is exactly the same. I did do that, and I did do this, and I did do that. They're the facts. But the conclusion is different. These are my words. The conclusion, the other one, the automatic one because of ego grasping, is therefore I'm a bad person. But here we change the conclusion, and this is the practice we have to do. We do accept that I did kick the dog, I did badmouth Ron, I did get angry, I did kill the ant, whatever, you know. Fact. But not therefore I'm a bad person. It's just too exaggerating. But what can I do to fix it? That's optimistic, it's humble, it's intelligent, and it's action. And that's how the change happens. Then we'll have courage. Like, in other words, instead of saying, oh, I ate all that sugar, I'm such a bad person, What good does that do? And there is no action in that. It's just you sit there in misery, in self-pity, thinking I'm a bad person and become worse. There's no action involved. But if you say, oh my God, I ate that sugar, quick, what can I do to fix it? That's dynamic, that's proactive, that's intelligent, and that is self-respectful. Guilt is self-loathing. Guilt is no sense of responsibility at all, but it's primordially deep. And again, don't blame your Jewish mother or your Catholic mother. It's the function of ego grasping. So it takes time to change it. We have to understand logically. Then we can start to change it by arguing with it conceptually. So then the first step has to be, if you sowed seeds in your mind from killing and stealing and lying, which if you leave them there will ripen as your future suffering, and again this regret is based completely on understanding the logic and the mechanics of karma, then of course you're going to have enormous sense of, oh my God, what a fool, like eating that sugar. I don't want diabetes, no way. Quick, what can I do to fix it? I don't want to have suffering in the future. Quick, what can I do to fix it? This is intelligent. So it's a powerful first step, necessary first step. Demands accountability. And I like to think this practice is like, it's like being kind to yourself. You're learning to be your own friend. It's a really positive practice, you know. You use the Buddha, like in the second step, we're going to bring the Buddha in, but it's not, you know, you're talking to yourself, really. You're doing the work. You're doing it. You use Buddha as your mentor, as your doctor, but you do the work. So then, of course, you can think of all the things you've done in this life that you can remember, like I always think of my abortion, different things I've done to harm sentient beings, and then I regret. And then this is the thing about regret now. The meaning of regret, you say, I regret having done it. So then what do you say? But the key thing is regret. The energy of regret, therefore, the energy of regret is, and you spell it out to yourself, you know what, Rabina, I regret doing that action. Why, honey? Because I don't want that seed to ripen as my future suffering. Just like the automatic view of eating the sugar, you don't have to practice regretting eating it because you know immediately it'll bring the bad result. So you've already owned that. You know it's going to bring diabetes and you have a horror. Oh my God, I don't want diabetes. Quick, how can I fix this? Because you understand the method, you understand the technology, you understand diabetes will come. Here, we're talking about future suffering will come. And this, of course, as always, for all of us, is very abstract. So we're going to have confidence in that view. So you spell it out. I regret killing, lying, stealing, bad-mouthing, whatever I did. Because you know what, Rabina? I don't want the future suffering. I'm sick of suffering. I'm sick of suffering. You've got to know that and feel it and be sincere about it and get this recognition that the suffering you do have, which is the cause of your own, the result of your own karma, is what you're sick of and you're regretting the actions now. You don't want the future result. So that's the energy that gives you renunciation, that gives you this energy to regret, that gives you the basis for wanting to change. This is all about ourself. And the way we would say it in our culture is this is having incredible compassion for yourself. It's not that punitive, moralistic, guilty, bad approach we think of when we think of religion, you know. It's not like that at all. That's regret. It's for your sake. Then you think, of course, if you have an understanding of past lives, and you know what, I regret anything I've ever done since beginning this time with my body and speech to harm any sentient being. All the vows I've ever broken, all my commitments, I regret these from the depths of my heart because there's no way I want future suffering. This is a powerful psychological view. It's ownership. It's responsibility based on self-respect. So then you think, second step, whom can I turn to? Where's the doctor? Well, there's a basis. There's two things that are based on why you go to a doctor. One, you've got to want their medicine. And why? For preventative or curative, isn't it? That's it. That's why you go to a doctor. You don't go to a doctor because she's cute. Not, you know, it might be cute. You go because you want her methods. It means you've checked up on her. You've checked up and she's a valid doctor. That's the point. So two things. One, you want the methods because you're sick of suffering. And two, you've got confidence that she's a good doctor. That's exactly the same with the Buddha. That's refuge. So, as you know, if you do this formal practice in meditation, as we know, the third step includes the visualization of this Buddha recitation of the mantra, Vajrasattva, for example, we'll do the meditation, recitation of the mantra and visualization, et cetera, et cetera. So here, in the second step, when you think this refuge, whom can I turn to? You visualize above your head the Buddha and you kind of delight that you found a doctor who's got decent methods, you know. Second part of reliance, it's very curious. It's called reliance. So it's important we understand this. And in particular, when we get to the eight verses and the transforming problems section, it's really important to understand this approach. It's kind of odd. We don't think like this, so I'll explain. So under here, the second part of reliance is where we now cultivate compassion for those we've harmed. The first step is like compassion for yourself. Here we now think of those we've harmed, and if you like, we now have a sense of regretting for their sake now, and that means having compassion for them. The first step is like for yourself. It's really specific. This is now for the sake of others. So here, so you have to ask the question then, why is that under the heading reliance? What do you mean relying? Relying on the Buddha makes sense, but here we've got to understand what they mean. It's kind of curious. So the point here is, in the second part, when we're trying to have compassion, the energy of the Bodhisattva, which we're trying to replicate, is this powerful wish to grow all this compassion so I can get rid of all these ridiculous delusions, so I can be of incredible benefit to others. It's a really powerful wish, not just to have gooey feelings for people, but a really powerful wish that I want to cultivate this compassion. I want this compassion at all costs. So I'm going to, you know, and you want to, so what is it you need? This is the point now about rely. What do you need most in order to cultivate compassion? It's very clear, but we don't think of it like this. You need to see and know about suffering sentient beings. If you want to become the best doctor on the planet, you want to become you got enthusiasm. You won't just sort of put your little plaque, your little sign up and dispense a few Band-Aids. You will go to the war zones, won't you? You will go to the war zones and the doctors sans frontières, whatever they're called in Italian. You will go to the worst scenario where the most suffering people are, and you pull your sleeves up with happiness and you get in there. So in order for you to become the best doctor, you want the worst suffering people. In order for you to become the best Buddha, you want the worst suffering people. So you rely on suffering sentient beings. The more, this is the absolute basis of the eight verses. The more crazy sentient beings are, the more grist for the mill they are for you in trying to become a Buddha. That's why the Bodhisattvas don't want to go and live in the trees and be on their own. They're not selfish. They'd rather be in the middle of all the crazy people. That's grist for their mill. That's what increases their capacity for incredible compassion. That's what it means by rely upon suffering sentient beings. That's why it's under this second heading of reliance. It's this courageous attitude. So in the second, we then think of those we've harmed. If we're brave enough, we can then think and have compassion for those who have harmed us. Now, this is the Bodhisattva level, and we're going to get to that in the eight verses. But if we're not capable of that, then you don't go there. You just do this and you contemplate these things. You think this through, you know. But you can't go further if you can't do the first one. If you can't recognize that you're rubbish, you're killing, you're stealing, you're lying, you're bad-mouthing is harming you, and you're sick of suffering, you can't really have, genuine compassion for those you have harmed. Because you're always trying to get yourself off the hook. Well, it wasn't really my fault. I couldn't help it. You've got to own it first. Then you're going to have genuine compassion for the people you've harmed, taking responsibility, you know. And then you're brave enough to have compassion even for those who've harmed you. Why? Very simple. Because they will suffer unbearably in the future because of what they've done. And if you don't get that for yourself in the first step, you'll never get that for sentient beings in the second step, which is compassion wing. Third, you take the remedy. So there's a whole medicine cabinet of remedies in Buddhism. This is often referred to as the antidote. So obviously the antidote to anything that you've regretted is to do the opposite. So throughout your life, obviously, you make a special effort to stop killing. You make a special effort to help sentient beings. If you regret lying, you make a special effort to tell the truth. You apply the antidote. But here, we do it in a formal practice, using the Buddha, which is said to make it very powerful, visualizing Vajrasattva. And we'll do this later. And you visualize these different things, just using your creative imagination, basically, to visualize purification and the recitation of Vajrasattva's mantra. It's said to be a really potent medicine, the remedy, the third one. And the fourth one, as Pabongka Rinpoche says, is the most important. The resolve to stop doing it. Pretty obvious. So that's where you reiterate your vows. I will never kill. I will never lie. I will never... And what you're doing in this fourth step, you're digging deeper and deeper in your mind this habit, this deep groove to never kill again. Whereas the boy who was the fisherman, he just suffered in the lower realms. He didn't make any decisions to keep not killing. He gets a human body, and the tragedy is he keeps killing. Straight back to the lower realms. That's the tragedy for humans, you know. So these four, we've got time for lunch now, we'll go into these later more, but these four also, each of these four has a particular function of purifying each of the four ways that karma ripens. So the first one, regret, is very powerful. You know, that purifies the karma called experiences similar to the cause. So all the bad stuff that happens to us, you know, being bad-mouthed at work, being rejected by your husband, people thinking you're lying when you're not, all the abuse we get from others, this is the result of actions like that in the past that we have done. So regretting now the actions we've done that harm others, that will ripen in the future in particular as not having that result. It purifies that result. So a very powerful way to use this in your daily life. Let's say, you know, you've been accused by your boss of doing something you didn't do. Let's say your friend and, you know, criticised you for doing something you didn't do. Someone said you lied, but you didn't. We know the pain of this is unbelievable. It's so painful. And all we try to do is get the person to see the truth. But what we don't realise is that's the fruit of our karma and a past life ripening as an experience now, of having done that to them before. In general, you can argue that karma is pretty personal, you know. So if you, there you are, being criticized, instead of all that incredible pain, wishing the person to see the truth, feeling so angry, feeling so righteous, feeling so self-pity, I don't deserve this, I didn't do anything to deserve this, if you take the view of karma, which is difficult, but if you apply it, you know logically it's from the past. So then you think, well, you know what, I regret whatever I did in the past, it is now ripening right now as this person harming me. And then don't be surprised, it starts to change. I promise. Don't be surprised. It's very powerful. Because you're purifying the root cause. Your past action. The second one, reliance, is said to purify the environmental result. The third one purifies the lower realms. And the fourth one is obvious. When you continue to vow never to kill, never lie, never steal, it obviously purifies the habit, which is the key one. That's why most humans in this life will go straight to the lower realms, because they all keep killing and lying and stealing, because they didn't purify the causes. That's the tragedy. That's the basis of having such compassion for sentient beings, the pedophiles, the terrorists, the ex-husbands, because they've got those habits. That's the basis of real compassion. That's the basis of real compassion. And we will not know that in the compassion wing until we've done junior school. Understanding karma, you know. All right, so we think of lunch differently. We can think of it again as the act of all the handiwork of all these kind sentient beings, people who cooked it and cut it and served it and grew it. And shopped it, and drove it, and, you know, sold it, not to mention all the billions of creatures who died, you know. I remember sometime one time on my Facebook page. I've got a Facebook page. I never look at it, but people put pictures on for me and do things. And I put a picture of me in England. This is years ago. I always tell this story. We'll talk about all this later. A picture of me buying some cheese in this amazing cheese shop. And it was called Kick-Ass Cheddar. Kick-Ass. Kick-Ass. You know that one in Italian? How do you say that? You know the one American saying? Yeah, Kick-Ass, yeah. Kick-Ass Cheddar. Anyway, whatever. So all these fundamentalist vegans got very upset. How dare a Buddhist nun eat cheese? This kind of thing, right? And I say fundamentalist purposely. I'm not complaining about vegan. I'm saying fundamentalist. So I didn't want to be political. But I'd always wondered how many creatures get killed on the road when you drive a car. And sure enough, you Google it, and some Dutch guy had done the research. And it was like per number plate, per car, per kilometre. I forget the numbers. It was unbelievable, like trillions of little sentient beings get smashed to smithereens, you know. But we don't think about them. We don't care about them. So I put that on the page. And then, you know, and one guy kept arguing with me. Well, you can't help that. But the thing is, just because if we ate those bugs, then we'd be in trouble with the vegans. But if you don't eat them, we don't care what happens to them. That's very stupid. That's very ridiculous, you know. So anyway, what I'm saying is, all these creatures might be vegetarian. That's fine, but don't feel too holy. Billions of creatures died for this food. So we think of them. And we think we're going to eat this delicious food to repay the kindness of all these creatures who died and all these kind people who did the food and gave it to us. Like a miracle, you know. How fantastic. Lama Sange Lama Che, Dejen Lama Gedon Te, Kungi Jebo Lama Te Lama Namla Che Pa Bull. And just for the thoughts, the dedication, just thinking, all these thoughts we've had since we started this morning, 9:30, as many thoughts as we've had is as many seeds we've planted. How marvellous. May we nourish these seeds with our effort from this moment forward so that they do ripen in the future, no matter how long it takes, in the development of our amazing potential for our sake and the sake of others. So now what I want you to do, you people, lunch, discussion, have relax until one. Oh, you only got 1 hour off, isn't it? Ooh. So 1:30 to 3:30. 2:30 to 3:30. Well, you can make it. Huh? What? Who said something?
Yes, I'm saying.
Oh, yeah. Is it? I know, it's only 1 hour for lunch. You're going to be a bit busy.
No, it's just like that 1 hour, yeah.
I know, but then you've got meditation for half an hour. You know, I've said an hour for discussion, but my thinking is you haven't got. This is my mistake. You've got too. It's going to be too busy. You're going to be too many things. You'll be exhausted. So why not have? You can do a discussion the whole 2 hours if you like. You can sit together for 2 whole hours and discuss.
No, but this one, but, Rina,
what?
From 2:30 to 3:30.
I know, but I'm saying is it seems a bit long.
1 hour.
Because they've got not much time enough off. So what I'm suggesting is, listen. You got your schedule. 12:30, 1:30 is lunch. Then it says 2:30, 3:30 discussion.
Yes.
And then it says meditation. So you can be quite busy. So what I'm suggesting is maybe you have 90 minutes off, relax, if you want. And then 30 minutes discussion. That's all I'm suggesting. If you want, it's up to you guys. And I can't force you. But I really recommend you get into a little group of 3 people, 4 people. And you chew over what you've just heard. Be very specific. Don't talk about what you read in a book last week. Just what we've discussed. Two of you, even 2 people is the best. If you want to discuss for 2 whole hours, it's up to you. But I'm suggesting have a bit of time off, you know. So maybe 30 minutes discussion. But try and make it very focused and very specific. Right? And then relax. And then you've got your meditation at 3 o'clock, 3:30. And then 4 to 5. Oh, 4:30 to 7:30. Okay. Then you have a half hour break again. It's okay. You have another half hour break after that. And then back. I'll see you back here at 4:30. Are we communicating here? Or a bit confusing? So meanwhile, relax and enjoy and discuss. Do what you can. Make the most. Try and think of every minute of the day as all part of the course. Don't think, oh, now I can relax and not think about it. No, it's all Dharma. So make it relaxing and make it Dharma and have fun as well. All together. Okay? Thank you. I'll see you all later. Thank you so much.